Daniel chapter 2. Title of the message tonight is Nebuchadnezzar's Dream, The Great Image. The Great Image. A lot of possibilities for this dream probably were racing through the wise men of Babylon's minds. They were only a horsehair from being executed. Some of them most likely had already been executed. But we learned last week about Daniel and how that he and his buddies, they sought the Lord. And when the executioner came to round them up, they said, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, don't be so hasty about this. Let us talk to the Lord." And that's where we ended last week. Daniel had gone before Nebuchadnezzar and asked for an extension of time, which Nebuchadnezzar gave to him. We don't know how long that time was, but we think that it was probably a short time. And so these men had a little reprieve before their heads would be cut off. And so they probably have a lot of things running through their minds, but Daniel is not like everybody else. Daniel has already talked to his Lord. He already has the answer. And so tonight, we're going to see what that dream is, and we're going to see an interpretation of that dream. And so I want us to look at just two things this evening. I want us to look at the description of the dream, and then we're going to look at the decoding of the dream. And so I hope tonight, as we go through these verses, that maybe you'll jot some notes down in the margin of your Bible. And we will just go through these two things. And then next week, and I think I'm going to be able to get through verse 45 tonight. But next week, I'm planning on starting in verse 46 through verse 49 with the reaction of Nebuchadnezzar to the interpretation. But tonight, we're simply looking at the dream, how that it has been revealed. And as we look at that, it seems as though that Nebuchadnezzar is just in awe of Daniel. We'll see how that later on Nebuchadnezzar wants to bless Daniel, and how that because of Daniel's friends, he wants to bless them as well. And so tonight I want us to begin with the description of the dream. Look with me at verse 31. And he simply says this: "Thou, O king, sawest, and behold, a great image." You notice the little word A there, just that one little letter. That means that this image was singular. It was like one person, one body, one individual. And so he said, "You saw one single great image." The word great, whenever I look at that, I think of the word huge. I think of something that is just massive. I like to watch historical things on television. Sometimes I will click on maybe an app of something, let's just say like the History Channel, and I will watch something like the great wonders of the world. And there is one particular wonder that has always fascinated me, and it's the Colossus. I just like watching the Colossus. It was there at the mouth of the harbor. I think it was Greece. And as you look at that, you have these boats that would come by, and the huge Colossus is so massive that the ships are as almost as they're just little tiny rowboats, when in reality, it could be some type of merchant ship. It may be some type of ship that is powered by slave labor, and they may have 100 or 200 slaves down on the lower decks of the vessel But it was pale. It would be pale in comparison as far as size to the Colossus. Well, that's the picture that I have of this great image. Your picture may be different, but he says that it is a great image. It's a singular image. And then it says, whose brightness was excellent. The brightness there is, in the Hebrew, it means to be exceeding bright. It is something that is just reflective, and it's a highly reflective type thing. When I was a kid, I used to like to play with mirrors in the sun. I don't know if you've ever done anything like that, where that you take and you reflect things. Those types of playtimes always fascinated me. Well, when you look at the brightness of this excellent image, imagine something that is maybe 70 feet tall, which is higher than the room here. And you're standing there and you're just looking up to that. And this is made out of metals, and it is so polished that that sun is reflecting off of that. And when you see that brightness, and it was excellent, and it stood before thee. In other words, he was just kind of standing there, and the form thereof was terrible. It was frightening. Now, the word form is a way for you to visualize this image. Well, because of the fact that it says that the form of it was terrible or frightening, that means that there was a demeanor about that statue that was, it was scary. And so you've got this form that is scary, and you can visualize in your mind. You remember things that where some big guy, somebody that's, you know, maybe 6'6", 6'8", 7 foot tall, and they're just huge and they're massive and they're looking down on you. Well, if they're standing there and they've got a smile on their face, the form thereof is not as frightening. But if there is a scowl on their face, you may be thinking, that's trouble. Years ago, we had a family in the church. They have left, and they work in another church, actually, in the ministry of that church now. But she told me one time, she said, you know, you scare me to death. And I said, why? She said, you look like you could just rip somebody's head off. And I said, have I ever said anything ugly to you? She said, no. Have you ever heard me say anything mean or ugly to anybody else? She said, no. I said, do I smile when I talk to you? And she said, well, yeah, sometimes. But sometimes when you're preaching, I just get the thinking that I could have my head ripped off by that man. And I said, I'm just a lovable little fuzzball, all right? But yet evidently my demeanor has not always been as easing as I would like for it to be around her. And we laugh about that now, but that was when they first started attending the church. And when I think about this image, I'm thinking, it was probably pretty frightening. When I see this, I'm thinking, well, you're standing there, let's just say he was 6 foot tall, and he's looking at something that's 15 times taller than he is. And that is intimidating. And so we see that there is this image. And can you imagine in Nebuchadnezzar's, always want to call him Nehemiah, can you imagine Nebuchadnezzar's mind? That here this young man is, he's about 18 years old now, and he's telling me exactly what I dreamed, and he's going to tell me what it means. He is probably in awe. As a matter of fact, in our text tonight, when you go from verse 30, 31 all the way through verse 45, I don't think Nebuchadnezzar even speaks. Now, he'll speak beginning verse 46. And when he speaks, there's going to be a humility that steps into his life. I think I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, I really think that Nebuchadnezzar may have become an Old Testament saint. There are glimpses of this man knowing about the Lord and becoming a follower of the Lord. Now, the Lord has to deal with him harshly on a few occasions. We'll get to that as we get through more of Daniel. But I just kind of believe that old Nebuchadnezzar, he might have been a saint of God, because the things that Daniel will tell him, even beginning tonight, he's going to be told some truths, and I think that he responds to this in an affirmative way. And so we see that there is a great image, it's a singular image, it's a bright image, it's a frightful image. But then he begins to tell him what the image looked like. And so, verse 32, it says that the image had a head that was made of fine gold. Gold is the most precious metal in, well, probably ancient times and possibly even today. I've known of people that they just absolutely love dabbling in gold. I know so little about it, I'd probably lose everything that I had trying to dabble in it. But there are some people that really love dealing with gold. They call it a hedge against inflation. And maybe they're right. And I know that inflation is an awful thing. If you want to visualize what inflation will do, imagine that you have a nice big pot of soup. And it's a healthy soup. It's a thick broth. And tomorrow, you pour in a 32-ounce tumbler of water. What happens? It thins it. And the next day, you put another tumbler in, and you thin it more. You do that for about a week, pretty soon you got colored water. You don't have good soup. That's what inflation does to an economy. And so you've got this gold head. Well, not only that, if you keep reading, it says that the breast and his arms, that's the image's arms, they were of silver. His belly and his thighs of brass. His legs, I take that from the knees down, to be iron. And his feet, part of iron and part of clay. And so we see that there is the gold, there's the silver, there's the brass or bronze, and then there is the iron, and now there's a fifth thing, that is the iron that has a mixture of clay in it. And so we look at that, and then I want you to notice verse 34. Thou sawest, and notice the next word, till. All right? Let me tell you what I take this to be. I take this to be that Nebuchadnezzar is standing there, and this image is just upright and it's stationary. Just think about you going and looking at a statue. You're just observing. You're just looking at it. You're looking at its form. You're looking at the head. You're looking at the chest. You're looking at the midsection, the thighs, and then you're looking at the legs. And you're just there, and it's just a still. Nothing moving about it. But then something happens. It says, thou sawest till that a stone was cut without hands. And what happened? It smote the image upon his, the image's feet, that were of iron and clay, and break them to pieces. So you're there and you've got a still, you're looking at it, and then all of a sudden something catches your eye out of the heavens, and a huge stone crashes into the feet mixed with clay. And so when you see that, it goes immediately from a portrait to a video. That's what his dream is. And Nebuchadnezzar, he has got to be just awed at this. He's got to be, just impressed that this young boy is able to do what the astrologers and the Chaldeans and all of the wise men of Babylon could not do. And so you have this stone, and it smote the image. Now, let me mention four things about this stone. And if you're taking notes, you can jot these down quickly. First of all, the stone was made in heaven, not by man. That's important. When you think about empires and you think about one conquering another, often we think of a stronger empire conquering a weaker empire. We can think about World War II and how that the Allies were stronger than the Axis, right? And so here, though, you have got something God made and not man-made. God is always better. God is always stronger. He is omnipotent, whereas men are always finite. They're always limited in their abilities and in their strengths. Second thing, it hit the feet and the clay that was made with the iron. It hit the feet. It did not hit the legs. It did not hit the midsection. It did not hit the chest. It did not hit the head. It hit the feet. And so when it hit the feet, we need to remember that it took them down at the really one of the weakest parts. Now, it could have crushed it from the head. If God wants to, he can take the head out. It could have been crushed from the chest. It could have been crushed from the midsection. It could have been crushed from the legs, from the knees down. But the stone went toward the feet. And so, you see that the statue is crushed, but it's crushed completely. How completely? Well, look back at our text. I want you to look at verse 35. It says that then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together. When this stone hit, evidently the crushing was so complete that not only did it take the feet with iron mixed with clay, but it crushed everything else as well. And to show you how complete this crushing was, when these pieces were broken together, they became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. So what you've got is you've got this image, and there's going to be an interpretation in a moment, but you've got this image. It's gold, it's silver, it's brass, it's iron, and it's iron mixed with clay. A stone comes out and crushes the feet, and evidently the stone keeps working and it crushes all of the other metals. And then it's like someone on a threshing floor taking kernels of wheat or kernels of barley or rye, throwing it up and letting the winds just blow the chaff away, blow the husk away. And when the threshing floors are done, all the chaff is gone, and all that's left is the grain. All that is left here is a stone. And what happens to this stone? Well, it becomes a great mountain. Often in the Bible, when you see mountains, it has the idea of a powerful kingdom. And so you've got this stone that is becoming a mountain. And how massive is this kingdom going to be? It's going to fill the whole earth. And so that is the description of this image. the description of the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. Now, I want you to look with me at what I'm calling the decoding of the dream. Well, when I'm talking about decoding, I'm not talking about the Da Vinci Code. All right? Years ago, there was a lot of movies that that would have, themes where that they would have to look at clues. All right? I think there've probably even been games where that people would get in their cars and radio stations would give clues and they would drive all over the cities that they were in. And what were they trying to do? They're trying to figure out what's going on. They're decoding all of this stuff. Well, Daniel is about to decode what Nebuchadnezzar has dreamed. All right? Let's pick up in verse 36 and we will begin to just kind of walk through these verses step by step. And this is the dream, and we will tell you the interpretation thereof before the king. Now, until this week, I had never seen and really paid much attention to a word that's in verse 36. Look at that again, and it says, this is the dream, and we will tell you. Now, you don't find anybody talking except Daniel. But when I see the word we, I think that he's got his buddies with him. I think that he has the three Hebrew children, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. We have those three guys. And I think they are probably there. They had already helped him pray. They had already gone to the Lord with Daniel. And so I had never seen this before until this week. And it says, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. Now, verse 37, one of the things that I think is pretty interesting is the way that Daniel addresses the king with great respect. Daniel, even at a young age, is no fool. He has excelled in the 3 years that he has been going to, Babylonian U. He has expelled, and he and his buddies are 10 times better than everybody else that graduated with him. They are just head and shoulders above everybody else. Well, you don't get to be head and shoulders above everybody else by being stupid. So what is he doing? He is giving respect to the man that could kill him with one simple word or one simple motion of the hand. And so, how does he do that? He says, thou, O king, art a king of kings. Now, for the Christian, Jesus is our King of Kings and Lord of Lords. But if we lived in ancient times, I don't think there's anything evil about Daniel saying this. If you notice, the word king there is in the lowercase. I think it's simply saying this, that you are first in line among all the kingdoms of the world. You're the most powerful. Now, if you were to take a map of ancient Babylon, it was not where we're at today in the United States, all right? But in the known world, Babylon became the first really world empire. Nebuchadnezzar had power that none had ever had before him. And so, to give him the title of King of Kings is simply saying, you're the most powerful, you're first in line. But then I want you to notice how it's qualified. He says, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, and the beasts of the field, and the fowls of the heavens, hath he given into thine hand. And he hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold. So in other words, he gives him praise, but then he says, God's the one that placed you here. Well, that's the second time that Daniel has referenced that. We won't go back to it, but I think it was either last week or the week before, whenever we were in the first parts of this chapter, it talks about that the Lord sets some up and takes some down. And so here he is one more time working God into the conversation. And I truly believe this. I believe that people of God ought to figure out some way to get God into the conversation when they're talking with people. We need to let them know that we're God's people. We need to let them know that we love Jesus. It doesn't matter. I mean, you can be any and everywhere. And if you really think about it, you don't have to just blow them right out of the water. I mean, I've known of preachers. I remember Carl Hatch. I graduated from high school with Carl Hatch's daughter. Her name's Debbie. Good name. And so Carl Hatch was witnessing to a man one time, and the man was a lawyer. And he said, let me tell you, I know the greatest lawyer that's ever been. And the man said, really? He said, who would that be? And Carl Hatch goes, oh, he's the greatest advocate of all time. And finally the guy goes, well, who is it? And Carl said, Jesus. He is my advocate. Did you know that my lawyer stands in the throne room of God and makes intercession on my behalf right now? And he was able to interject God into a conversation with an attorney by using a strategy of just finding something that this guy was familiar with, and he used that to make sure that he was able to witness to him. He was witnessing to a group of nuns one time, and he asked one of them and it was kind of a captive audience, they were on an airplane together, and he said, sister, let me ask you a question. He said, if you had sin in your life, can you go boom straight to God if this plane crashed? And she's like, what do you mean? Well, I mean, if this plane crashed and you had sin in your life, could you go to heaven, or are you going somewhere else? And she was like, well, I guess I'd probably go to purgatory. And he was talking to her and he goes, I got direct access. And she looked at him and said, what do you mean you got direct access? He said, I don't have to go nowhere. I've trusted Jesus. I don't need a priest. I don't need somebody to pay for me to get out of purgatory. I don't need a priest to intercede for me. I've got a high priest. And he used that as a way to witness to a couple of these nuns. We ought to be able to work out somehow to get Jesus in the conversation. And so we see that he is this head of gold. Look at verse 39. And after these shall arise another kingdom. Now we already know that the second is silver. And this kingdom is going to be inferior to thee. Now I'm sure that Nebuchadnezzar liked hearing that. He probably liked the fact that he was number one on the list. And so he was superior to the next kingdom that was going to come along. And another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth. So in one verse, we have the two succeeding kingdoms that are going to follow the gold. So we have the gold that's the head, which is Babylon. We have the silver, which we will come to know as the Medes and the Persians. There is the brass, which will be known as Greece or Alexander the Great. You may put those two words together, Alexander and Alexander and Greece. They go together. And then the fourth kingdom in verse 40 is going to be strong as iron. It's not going to be as valuable when it comes to the metallic aspect of it, But when it comes to strength, nothing beats iron. If you've got an iron sword, it's going to beat a gold sword. If you've got an iron sword, it's going to beat a silver sword. If you've got an iron sword, it's going to beat a brass sword. The gold, the silver, the brass, all of those are soft metals compared to iron. And so you've got this fourth kingdom, and it's going to be strong as iron. For as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things. Now, when you think about iron, and we are going to connect that with a fourth empire, which we know as Rome. Now, there's a group of liberals that I'll get to in a moment that hold to a whole different idea about Daniel's dream. And I'll explain that in just a few minutes. But what you've got is, you've got this iron that is strong. There's never been an army in ancient times that was stronger and more powerful than Rome. Never. You have, I'm talking about the heel of Rome. Now, Rome was a very, they were an easygoing people as long as you were subdued. They let you worship any god you wanted to worship. Then they began to blame Christians for some of the things that would happen, and I think that it probably started just before Nero, and it went all the way until you got to Constantine in the early 300s. And you had a great persecution under Diocletian. And all of those things, Rome began to put their iron heel on Christians. But in the early years, they didn't care. As long as when they said do something, you did it. And if you rebelled, they came after you hard, fast, and they made an example of you. That's why when you visit Israel and you go to a place like Masada, you hear the story of that, and you understand why those people on top of that fortress, why they killed each other, because they didn't want to suffer the sufferings and the brutality of the Romans, so they just killed themselves so they wouldn't experience it. You had all of those people, and they took 10 men. They chose them by lots. And by the way, they have found some of those lots through excavating there on top of Masada. And so you have these lots and these 10 men, and what did they do? They went and they killed all the people, with the exception of 2 women and 5 kids. And so they were, and by the way, those 2 women and those 5 kids, the reason they didn't die is because they were hiding. And they are the ones that actually told the story of Masada, and that's why we know it today. But these Romans, they sieged that fortress. They built a ramp, and they went up that ramp, and they conquered that place. You know why? Because the Jews had rebelled, and they would not put up with a rebellion. They would crush it and grind it into pieces. And so you've got these iron legs, and it says they're going to break in pieces and subdue all things. And they're going to break in pieces, they're going to bruise. And so we see that you've got the all four kingdoms, and what have you got? You've got each one of them, and each is identified by a different country. Let's look at verse 41. Let's go there. And whereas thou sawest the feet and the toes, part of the potter's clay, and part iron. So you've got clay and iron that's mixed. The kingdom shall be divided. Now historically, and we'll see this again later on, but historically, the Roman Empire split. It split into the east and the west. And so the kingdom is going to be divided. So the picture is those iron legs, and they are now divided. And then it says, but there shall be in it the strength of the iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry or just common clay. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. Iron and clay do not mix. Now you can put them together and you can try to meld them together. But ultimately the clay will not adhere to the iron. We would say something like this. We would say it's like gas and water. You have gasoline and you put water with it. And if you have some type of clear container that you can look into, what do you see? You see that ultimately the two will separate and you can literally see the dividing line of the two. Well, that's what you have in the iron and the clay, feet and toes. And so, verse 43 says, "And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry or common clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men." Now that's a phrase there's a lot of disagreement about. Some people think that that has the idea that there's a lot of intermarriages going on between countries and races. I simply think that in the Roman Empire that you had all different types of people. After there would be some victorious a conquest of the Romans, often the Caesar, to make sure that the people that had been defeated stayed subjugated, they would give property to the soldiers so that those soldiers would go and they would live in those lands and they would have acreage that they would be able to survive on. And so that's the way that I read that when it talks about the people that they're going to, I guess, merge with. And so you've got the clay, you've got the iron that's not going to adhere with the clay. And in these days, verse 44, "And in these days the kings shall be, in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom." And if you go back to the dream, that kingdom was that stone that put that video in motion. It's not just a still portrait any longer. It is something now that has been sent from heaven. And he has set up a kingdom. And this kingdom is going to be unlike the first, the second, the third, and the fourth. It is never going to be destroyed. Nobody's ever going to break it in pieces. Nobody's ever going to consume it like all of these other kingdoms have been consumed. And so it's going to stand forever. Well, if you look at the latter part of verse 45, which is our last verse for tonight, it says, "And the dream is certain." That means that this dream is genuine. And when you read that, Daniel is saying, you don't have to worry about this interpretation. This is going to happen. So it is a sure thing. It's a sure bet. Now, let me just close with this. Everybody that I have ever been truly familiar with, that I've had confidence in, starting with Jack Van Impe in 1974, all right, going through Harold Wilmington in 1976, Hal Lindsey, you know, in the early 80s, then later on reading people like Wiersbe, Phillips, Rice, those types of guys. Every one of those men were what we would call premillennial. And I'm premillennial. Premillennial people believe in reading the Bible in a literal sense. We don't think that you have to make up meanings for various things in the Bible. We just let the Bible speak. And so, because of that, sometimes people accuse us of being simplistic. I plead guilty. I have no problem just reading the Bible and saying, wow, okay, that's what that says. This afternoon, about 3 o'clock, I checked some news sources, and I was reading some different columns from different columnists and giving their opinion about things like the economy and things about, you know, Ukraine, and I was just reading some of that. And do you know that as I was reading those articles, I didn't one time have this thought. Well, I wonder what he's really saying. You know, whenever he says that, you know, inflation is at 7.5%, do I really think that that's 7.5% in Georgia, or is that 7.5% in California, or is that 7.5% in all of America? And I just take it, well, he's talking about the country, so it's just countrywide. I don't begin to try to nitpick everything that he says. You know, now, we've had people in our past, such as presidents, that didn't know what the word is was. You know, we have that kind of stuff. But when I read an article, I just read it and say, well, that guy said this. Now, it's up to me to either believe it or not believe it. And that's what I do when I read the Bible. I just read it and say, okay, I believe that. That's what I believe. And so you have two views of Daniel's interpretation. You have a Roman view. And a Roman view is very simple. You have the first kingdom is Babylon, second kingdom is Medo-Persia, third kingdom is Greece, fourth kingdom is Rome, and then later on there's going to be the feet and the toes. Some people think that it's simply the revived Roman Empire. I happen to think that. And I think that at some point there'll be 10 nations. I have no idea what 10 it will be, and nobody else does either. But you and I, we can look at that and we can go, okay, from a reading of the book of Daniel, from a reading of Jeremiah and some Ezekiel, you can see that this is the order of things. But there's a second view that is called the Grecian view. This is people that they don't take Daniel's prophecies as being literal prophecies. They do not believe that the book of Daniel was written 500 years before Christ. They think that another Daniel wrote it in about 165 BC. That would be during the time that we know as the silent years, the 400 years between Malachi and Matthew. So about 165, you have the liberals and they say, there was another Daniel that wrote that. Well, they say that Babylon is the first, Medo was the second, Persia was the third, and Greece is the fourth and last. Now, the problem with that is when you get over to the other chapters and you begin to try to take the image and how that the two legs and the feet and the two arms and those types of things, how that they are placed side by side with the other dreams and images that we're going to see, you can't get them to match up. And so when I take the Roman view, which I'm assuming that most of you are going to take that if you have a conservative bent, which we all do at this church, it allows for us to read in just a normal way. One of the things that the Grecian holders hold to is that the Medes and the Persians, two separate kingdoms. The problem is when you read Daniel chapter 5, verse 28, it connects those two, talks about the Medes and the Persians. When you go on, it uses phrases like this in, I think it's chapter 6, the law of the Medes and the Persians. They're connected. And because of that, you have this kingdom that came together, and even though they are together, there is some schism there. You have the Medes and you have the Persians that really each one wanted dominance, and ultimately the Medes would really be subservient And you've got two men in the book of Daniel. You've got one, Darius, who was a Mede. Then you've got Cyrus, who was a Persian. Ultimately, Cyrus will be the leader over this whole group. But at the beginning, there were two parts. There were two arms. And so the Bible clearly states also, and one final thing, is that the third empire, the Grecian Empire, it will follow the second. There is not an allotment in the dream nor the interpretation for it to be a split between the Medes and the Persians. Those two are together in their conquering of Babylon in 539 BC. So, we have been introduced to the image tonight. Now, next week, we're going to look at the response of Nebuchadnezzar. We're going to see, when he hears this, how he reacts to this. How do we react to the truth? I hope that when we hear truth, that we react to it in a way, really, that's honoring to God. That's for next time. Let's stand together.